questions for you, which is a little bit of a different story.
Does that do it, Frank? Go ahead. W2BXO.
6-0. Again, the message I'm getting is make sure closed captioning is turned on at the box, not just on the TV. We're accustomed to turning on closed captioning at the television set. At this point, we still have a relatively old analog set in the house hooked up to the cable box, our only HD set at either of our houses, for that matter. Is getting a signal over the air. Interesting story. Anyway, yes, I think that answers the question very well. And I just had also wanted to toss out there, if anybody knows at some point what's going on with the W2LIEC. So I'm probably not going to need that one again for a number of weeks. I expect to be here the next couple of weeks. So Dick, back to Ness, I guess.
Thanks a lot, I'll be listening. Pete H. with a comment.
Yeah, Eric is the guy that can answer the question as to
question comment.
Eric can answer the question about W2LIE normally carries this net, and last week it wasn't being carried, and so Frank, among other people, has been asking that. Over to you, Eric.
No, I can't answer that because I actually don't know who they are and how they're getting it in the first place. But if you're doing it through IRLP, you can pick it up on 9126, but then, of course, you can talk on it. And if you're doing it via EchoLink, I don't remember the number, but it's N2SPU. That'll also let you listen to it and talk on it if you're lucky enough for somebody to leave a picking up port. K2RWK2J.
Which as soon as we carry and get rid of the two guys, I don't mean get rid of the guys, you know what I mean, handle the two guys who have got comments right now. Paul's been waiting for...
W2BXO.
Okay, Paul's been waiting patiently. WS2N, go ahead with your comment, Paul.
Okay, W2BXO is going to be interested in my comment. I have an observation. I don't understand the reason this happens, but with the HDTV that I just got a week or so ago, well, we run closed caption all the time, always did, and put the closed caption on the TV, and it didn't work. So just like the comments that have been going by, you really need to have it put on at the cable box. So, you know, through calling up cable vision, you know, they'll work you through it. It wasn't in the directions on how to get the thing going. So they work you through the setup, and you get the closed caption to come on. It still doesn't work unless for cable vision anyway. Now you have to go back to your TV and make sure that closed caption is on to make it work. But the question is originally had to do with the HDTV, maybe HDMI cable. Again, I found no difference between the HDMI cables or the component cables with the audio plugged in. No difference, except maybe in the audio. Eric might confirm that. But as far as closed captions, they were equal. But I think maybe what he's getting at is some people have made comments, let me drop it, about watching HDTV closed captions. I found now we have the capability to switch back and forth, back, you know, to standard or back to HDTV. When I go back to standard, again, it's all going through the HDMI cable, so I think that's irrelevant. But when you go back to standard and you're watching, for instance, channel 9, regular channel 9 standard, the closed caption is coming up perfect. Stays on screen long enough to read. You go to channel 9, HDTV, you'll see that closed caption come on, but it comes on in a flash. I mean, it comes on and it's gone. I mean, unless you can read about 300 words a minute, you're not going to get this. So I have found that that's a problem. I'm still working on it. I'll probably have to call, make a couple of phone calls on how to straighten that out. Maybe there's some settings in my TV. I know there's closed caption 1, closed caption 2, closed caption 3, and closed caption 4. Maybe that makes changes. I haven't gotten into it yet. But maybe that's what BXO is thinking about, you know, somebody might have said something, you know, watch out for the HD, maybe the HD TV, but not so much the cable. I don't think, like Eric said, I think the cable is irrelevant. The HDMI cable is really the way to go. I have found that it does improve the audio. Picture-wise, I can't see a difference. Just those observations, Dick. I don't have anything technical on it. Back to that. WXLM.
Very fine, Paul. Eric, do you have anything you want to add to that, why the closed caption only dwells for milliseconds on the screen? KE2EJ, K2LIW.
K2LIW,
K2EJ.
Okay. One thing I'll point out is that if you, sometimes you'll watch an HD channel and compare it to an HD channel, or you're looking at, no, you can't do it anymore because there's no more analog broadcasting, but you used to find the captions were like perfectly on time, and then when you looked over at the HD channel, it was kind of late, or sometimes it was actually early. That's because the standard definition stuff that they're playing is where they get the closed caption from. Even to this day, the industry really has a place for where the closed captions get stored in the digital domain, except that there's a lot of equipment out there that doesn't handle it. So what they do is they take the simultaneous SD feed and suck the captions off from that, and there's processing delay when you actually make the HD channel work from the time the video gets into it. So it comes out of that encoder. As far as the speed and captioning, if you're dealing with cable, cable has sometimes a tendency to get things messed up, and it's no fault of yours. Or sometimes it's the box is not separating the data properly. But if you're using a cable box as a digital cable box, and it's got an HDMI output, you'll find that. Sometimes it doesn't decode stuff right. Sometimes the actual content or the program material, captioning job on the HD part of it, if it's a later type of distribution, depends how it was distributed to the station. There's been a lot of variables involved in that, so don't be so quick to blame yourself when you see weird stuff like that. That's one thing that I'm going to drop. You'll find that the audio from the HDMI cable beats the pants off of the analog connections if you're using components. You may not see such a great difference in video because, first of all, if you're looking at HD, it's been compressed 50:1 to begin with. And most of the stuff out there is still being transmitted 8 bits, even though the HDMI cable will be 12 bits of video. That's at a pretty fast rate if you think about it. It's 1.16 gigabits. It's not slow stuff. But if you have like an up-converting DVD player and you're using HDMI and you're going using the up-converter part of it, you're absolutely looking at it because the up-converters in the DVD players are pretty lousy. You want to go back to the component because it wasn't better. K2RIW, K2RIW.
Thank you for the information, Eric. I do notice that when I couple the digital box to the television display device, an old-fashioned analog type television, what is it now? Panasonic, I think it is. 37-inch. I'm not even sure. But anyhow, when I use it in the channel 3 mode, where the analog signal is being modulated by the digital box, and I get a certain quality of picture, and I get a certain quality of stereo audio. And then when I flip over to composite video plus left-right audio by the auxiliary channel response of the television set, the picture stays almost identical. I expect there to be a great improvement in picture. And like you just explained, no great improvement in picture. But the audio does seem to have greater left-right separation when I do it that way as opposed to the analog stereo reception of left-right. Do you think that's characteristic of my set? Or is it possibly I'll get the left and right reversed and I'm just recognizing a difference and calling it extra separation? I haven't done a real study of this one yet, but and you might have a guess as to what could be going on in my case, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Same thing with FM stereo, Dick. You know, the specifications that you would like to hear, which you actually get. Now, if you're talking about a digital converter box, the actual audio separation is around 90-95 dB, depending upon what happened to the station and so on and so forth. But even FM stereo, you only get about 10, 12, 15 dB of separation at best, depending upon how you're doing it. But in television, there's in the audio, the deviation index, and that of the bandwidth in regular FM, plus or minus 75 kHz, whereas the audio for TV is plus or minus 25 kHz. And we also do some companioning there. We actually, it's a DBX circuit that's part of the whole stereo audio scheme. You're going to get like 12, 14 dB. I think the spec is like 22, which is not that good. So coming from something that's perfect, going into a modulator that really what it's doing is it adds the two channels together and takes one component, it inverts one component and takes the subtracted part and transmits that on another subcarrier. So it's doing some analog arithmetic as to where it matrix together and dematrix out, but it's not a perfect system, as if you're getting out of your digital TV tuner. K2R is W, K2J.
K2QIQ.
Quite recognized. Hey, you've hit on a very interesting subject. In the case of over-the-air FM broadcast, 88 to 108 megacycles, where you're allowed plus or minus 75 kc of deviation, 150 kc of plus or minus deviation, they're putting in a 19 kc pilot tone and a 38 kc suppressed carrier double sideband modulation with the A minus, the left minus right, as opposed to the left plus right on the common. There, you've got enough deviation to handle the 38 kc subcarrier. In the case of FM audio of television analog broadcast, where you're only allowed 25 kc, I think, of total bandwidth, plus or minus 12 and a half, in that case, how do you legally put in a 19 kc pilot and a 38 kc subcarrier without creating a bandwidth that exceeds the specification? Yes, you could use very low modulation index and make the amplitude of the 19 and 38 kc low, but still you're going to go out of the 25 kc of bandwidth. Is that part of why the separation on analog reception seems to be less, as opposed to the digital reception of left and right seems to have much greater separation? I think you're saying that's capable of maybe as much as 90? Wow. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
Yeah, K2IW, K2J. Excuse me. Actually, if you look at your CD, you could say something like minus 120. But that all depends upon, you know, you stick one thing into one channel, one thing to the other channel. You got to remember, you're creating two sets of numbers. One set of numbers for the left channel, the other set of numbers for the right channel. You got two D-to-A converters. You know, you feed them into a stereo amplifier, it's going to be crosstalk between the channels, but you're still talking 100 dB of separation or isolation between the one and the two. Don't forget what we do with audio in FM is we do mixing like we do with the color subcarrier. But the interesting thing is in television, first of all, it's plus or minus 25 kHz deviation, okay? Not 25 total. That would sound pretty bad. The subcarrier, the pilot, is actually locked to the horizontal frequency. It runs at 15,465 kHz. And that's the pilot, and the subcarrier is at 31.5, I think. Yeah, 31.5 and change. It's similar, but it's also reduced bandwidth, so the left minus right component is actually companded, so that way the dynamic range stays there, and you actually have a much lower deviation index on the subcarrier.
Okay, so the bottom line, plus or minus 25 kc of peak deviation, FM audio on analog television, what do you believe is a realizable left-right separation in that particular system using a 15 KC and roughly 30 KC subcarrier. What do you believe is a realizable preparation it has on that particular old-fashioned analog over the broadcast? How back to you, Eric?
No, it's not that much. It's like, it depends. I mean, you know, I think realistically, you know, I can look up the actual spec on the modulator. I think it's like 22 dB or less than that. But, you know, the reality is it's anywhere between 12 and 15 when you finally get to the output of the receiver.
That explains the difference that I heard. Glenn, KC2QIQ, go ahead with your question or comment.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if I was going to jump in and say a lot of what Eric just said, because right now, yes, FM radio, before FM radio started going digital, but right now, just talking about the analog version, you know, you're talking about a pilot carrier on FM radio, 19 kilohertz to 38, and just like Eric explained, your pilot carrier on television stereo before they went digital was 15 and 30, or a little bit higher than 15 to like 32. And then it was a little bit narrower, but not by a tremendous amount, so it was kind of similar to FM broadcast. But the, like Eric is saying, the best you can get on that FM multiplexing is like 15 dB, because it's not just the limitation of the transmission of the signal, it's also the receiver on the other end, because how you set the skirts on your receiver to separate the sidebands is going to give you that separation. And plus, you add on top of that, another problem is dynamic range. The dynamic range of the FM broadcast stereo multiplex isn't that great. Maybe at best, maybe 30 dB of dynamic range, which is awful, because everything's all compressed up from the broadcast end, and you have the same problem trying to decompress again on the receiver end, where with digital, all those problems go away, because once it's being broadcast, you can have very high channel separation, all depending on the digital demodulator, and it can do a beautiful job and get you something very, very close to CD performance. KC2QIQ.
Fantastic. Eric, roughly how many bits of dynamic range exist in the left and right channel of a digital TV audio broadcast? Rough numbers, Eric, go ahead.
Here's the problem. You don't realize it, but it's not TCM audio. It's not completely left channel, it's completely right channel. What it is psychoacoustical compression, which is a very interesting subject. And it's actually AC3. It's the same type of compression scheme that's used on your DVD. And what psychoacoustical compression does is it's actually invented by Dolby. Now, Dolby is known, Dolby A, Dolby B, Dolby C. Different, what they would do is take the audio and break it up into different sets of spectrum, okay? They would actually increase the amount of energy and reduce the amount of energy in these different bands of spectrum to maximize a linear flat reproduction at the end. That's in the analog domain. In the digital domain, they've come to this, actually it came about by doing a lot of physiological studies on human beings, and you ask the question, what can a human ear hear? Same thing with when we do video compression. What we really do is ask, what can the eyeball see? Well, you got stuff that you can see, and you got stuff that you don't see. So the stuff that you don't see, you leave out. Same thing with the psychoacoustical compression. The stuff that you can hear, and the stuff that you don't hear, you leave out the stuff that you don't hear. It takes up less room. So I'll give you an example. You're transmitting a Beethoven's fifth and you're in the fourth movement, and you know it crescendos up, and in the background there's this little tiny triangle. But if you really have really super whoopie-doo hearing, you're sitting in the first row, you're going to hear it. Guess what? The AC3 says it ain't there. I ain't going to bother. So now let me let it drop, and I'll add one more thing. The rate at which you send the data stream can be selected by you. You being the broadcaster. How you set your encoders up. Typically, on a DVD, it'll be 334 kilohertz of samples of AC3. It could also be 128. But the 333 is a pretty much, or 285 is a pretty much the standard numbers that people use. But if you're trying to pack a lot of TV channels into your data stream, you're going to reduce that because people forget that not only do you have to take up room for the picture, you take up room with the sound. Not only do you take up room with the sound, but when we're talking about digital television, you also take up room with the guy and whatever data that you happen to be sending. There's actually a packet in there called PID-911, which is the emergency alert system place of existence that the president's messages will actually pass. So, well, I'm going off in the wrong direction here. K2IW, K2JICO.
Interesting stuff. No, don't worry about going off in the wrong direction. Inside of each ham radio operator is a guy who wishes he was working in broadcasting. You've got that lucky position where you work in broadcast engineering. And so you've got the ideal position for a ham radio operator, Eric. And we're kind of envious of where you are and what you've got to say about all this jazz. Let me show you something else funny that's happening to me. Once in a while, there's a CBS program I want to watch, like 60 Minutes. And with my old-fashioned 25-year-old foam RG6 cable that went up to my UHF antenna on the chimney of the house, channel CBS, which is really UHF channel 33, came through pretty weakly. By that I mean the digital converter by Radio Shack gives you a bar graph, and the bar graph has got red. It's got three chunks to the bar graph: red, yellow, and green, I think it is. And so if I'm just barely at the upper end of red and just touching the lower end of yellow in signal strength, you will get a spotty picture and spotty sound. And sometimes it hangs in there for 30 solid seconds and then drops out for 10 seconds and so on. This weekend I replaced the cable, and now I'm getting fully yellow cable. In other words, I've got roughly, if the bar chart was linear, I'm getting twice the signal strength. But I'm still getting breakup of the audio. And occasionally, breakup of the picture, breakup of the audio, lower frequency, but I'm still getting breakup. Whereas there are other channels where half that signal strength will give me a steady signal on screen, picture and sound. So I'm getting enough signal strength if it is a signal strength indicator. But I notice that it does jump around a whole...
You're not on a rotor, are you?
Not on a rotor yet, and I'm guessing that it is a multipass phenomenon. I think you're saying when I put in the rotor, most likely that'll go away. Am I seeing a multipass phenomenon with the way it jumps around so darn much? Over to you, Eric.
All right, consider this. I'm going to try and make this real straightforward and simple. You have a 4,000-bit shift register, okay? You stick a bit in one end, 4,000 clock cycles, it comes out the other end. That represents a period of time. Agreed?
Sure does. That's a digital delay line, but go ahead.
All right. In that 4,000-bit shift register, the first 100 bits are the picture for the channel that you're watching. So between 0 and 100 is a packet worth, actually, if you want to do it right, between 0 and 188, you've got a whole bunch of packets there, minus the address headers, that says, this is CBS Channel 2, and this is the first group of pixels that's part of that picture. Then between 188 and the next 188, there's 188 bits worth of, let's call it, what channel am I on data? And contained in that is all the guide information. The guide information actually gets spaced out in many different places, but so that takes care of the next 188 bytes worth of that shift register, or bits worth of the shift register. Then, let's say the next 188 bytes is actually the sub-channel that might be playing. So, if we're not going to use channel 2 as an example, let's use 4. So, the first channel will be 4.1, the first 188 bytes of data. And the second group of 188 bytes of data will be channel 4.2, which is whatever their weather thing is. And then further down, so let's get down to maybe about, we're now at 1,000 by 10, we find the first packet of audio for the first channel. And then we keep going down, maybe another 1,000 bytes later, bits later, there's the audio for the second channel. And in between that is data and the EAS stuff and what channel this is and the station's call sign and all that identification stuff, and they may be transmitting some data to the fire department, which we actually do. So this is a repetitive cycle that occurs about the same place in time. So if you've got something that's messing you up around this number 2000 to 3000, and that's where the audio happens to be, that's where you're going to have problems.
EC2QAQ.
Interesting.
Go ahead, Glenn.
One thing I noticed very early on messing with high-definition TV, and I know the converters have improved and a lot of other things, but one of the things I noticed very early on was the type of coax that you're using and the return loss of the cable and measuring return loss of the antenna system back at the just before it goes into your digital conversion box. And that any kind of return loss problems you have in the cable and the bandwidth of the cable that you have can cause all those kinds of problems as you go from channel to channel. You'll notice one, the audio comes in good on one, video on another channel comes in better than the audio, and things like that. My question for you, Dick, is what kind of cable are you using right now off of your reception antenna? Is it something relatively new with like an RJ6 U with wide bandwidth for HDTV?
Oh, there's some really bad things in that. I bought this, I was in Lowe's, and I bought RCA brand RG6/SAT, and I installed the connectors on the end. And I put a weatherproof connector on the end that's up at the antenna end, and a gold-plated one, non-weatherproof, in the shack end, the house end. And I confirmed it with an ohmmeter that is making good contact to the TV aerials. And I eliminated all of my splitters and frequency dividers and everything else. That cable goes straight into the digital TV box. Now, have I measured the S11 of my particular television aerial on the chimney? No. Although I gave it a very hard visual inspection, it seems to be in very good shape. Back to you, Glenn.
Not necessarily that that's the problem, but it was something that I had learned how delicate it was to cable. And by actually measuring the return loss, I was able to make a couple of adjustments on my... I built my own first UHF-only antenna. I think I've mentioned that before. And I did a little bit of tuning and measuring S11 at the end of the cable. And the better I got the return loss at the end of the cable where it goes into the box, boy, wow, what a difference it made in the overall channels. But it was just a suggestion, KC2QIQ.
I've got a question for Eric now, and that is, Eric, multipath, when it comes to over-the-air broadcast, certainly can give you inter-symbol distortion, and the third packet of 188 in that great big string of information that's being transmitted, I can see how that can get corrupted. When it comes to the quality of the cable used for UHF television, I, for one, was using a 25-year-old piece of cable, although it was RG6 Radio Shack, for all I know it was Saxon. In those days, it wasn't a good brand. I'll have to take a good hard look at it, see what brand it was. I do notice that it had quite a bit of loss. I'm going to bring it into the factory one of these days and actually put it on the network analyzer and find out what the swept loss of that 40 feet of cable was, because I think by now it probably sucked up quite a bit of water. So I think an awful lot of people who are trying to get over-the-air UHF television reception for digital are probably using a pretty yucky, old-fashioned UHF antenna that has not been properly maintained. I suspect that some of the complaints for people who are not getting good over-the-air reception could be that aggravated situation. You might have some opinions on that one, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, let me point out a couple of things. When you were watching analog TV, did you care that you had little lines and noise and snow and stuff like that? You can look at people's antennas and find them missing reflectors, missing pieces of the director. And, you know, they're fine and dandy and happy. But your biggest enemy with digital television, this is where the cable business comes in, is you want to be able to send the energy from one end of the cable down to the other and not have it wind up back at the same end again and then being reflected back down. So, yeah, you want the best termination, the best source termination, and you really don't want any bumps in the cable on the way down or anything that's going to cause a reflection. That's your biggest enemy. Loss is not so much a problem as long as you're not doing any bouncing around and creating time delays. Whereas if the components come in and they come out, you know, exactly, you know, 1 nanosecond later, or however length of the, however long the length of the cable delay is, that's fine and dandy. I mean, you gotta remember, in New York here, we're at a disadvantage because we have a very messed up transmission system on Empire that nobody really seems to want to acknowledge, especially for us folks on Long Island. Whereas on the New Jersey side, it's not really anywhere near as bad. So, and up north, it's not anywhere near as bad. So, we get the worst of it. But the reality is that as long as you're not getting any of that kind of stuff, you just got attenuation, even an old junky cable is going to give you that. But the reality is, most people don't, you know, I always got a picture, why should I change it? KQRWK, do that.
And the good news is that on my UHF antenna, I did not get any ghosting. That suggests that I wasn't getting very much triple transit or a whole lot of multipath on the old-fashioned analog UHF reception I used to do. I do notice that a fair number of people are having trouble with CBS, which happens to be UHF 33, and 9, which happens to be UHF 38, whereas some of the others are coming through like gangbusters. NBC, for instance, which is 28 real, very few people are having any trouble with that one on Long Island. So I think you're saying the quality of the antennas are some of what's going on. And by the way, to put in a comment on what Glenn said before I turn it back to Eric, and that is, in the most ideal world, the antenna should be 50 ohms DC to light, and the converter box should be 50 ohms DC to light, and now you have no multipathing or triple transit or quadruple or pentapath transit taking place in your cable. That's the best of all worlds. The second best of all worlds would be for the sending end of the antenna S11 to be pretty yucky, and it's sending a signal down the cable, but as long as the converter box is 50 ohms DC to light, there is no reflection of the received signal. The worst case situation is where both ends have a pretty lousy S11 and S22, and now you get a signal bouncing back and forth at 40 feet of cable. That would be 80 plus the velocity factor. That's going to be 100 nanoseconds of delay on the triple transit, and I'm pretty sure that's a pretty nasty number when it comes to TV reception.
92 nanoseconds for a symbol.
Oh boy, I see it coming. So the fact that my cable is 40 feet long, making it almost 90 nanoseconds for the triple transit, I'm right in the bad position, aren't I, Eric? KE2EJ, KQRIW.
WHORY.
Joe recognized. Eric first. Go ahead, Eric.
Therein lies the problem. All right, let's give you something to think about. Now, you know, of course we've got these better equalizers today. They're still getting better, even though digital television really still doesn't work. But I take it back to 98. CBS had just come on with their digital transmitter. 99. There was this truck that a public, well, it was a huge truck that was set up to teach broadcasters about the new up-and-coming digital television. And the place where the truck was parked was in, before the Time Warner building was up there, you know, in front of the Coliseum. And no matter how hard they tried, because of the buildings there, they tried to pick up Channel 2 from Empire, and there was just no way that was happening, period. The Channel 2 had the digital transmitter at Empire. The World Trade Center was still up. But what did we do? We pointed the antenna at what was then the Gulf and Western building and took the reflection off the building. Okay, and by aiming the antenna just right, we were able to demonstrate digital television. By the way, it was a joint venture between PBS, Harris, and a couple other manufacturers in the ATSC. So it was a truck that actually went throughout the whole country to demonstrate this process to broadcasters. KTRIWK2J.
Fascinating. Let me jump for a second about Bill's earlier question that you didn't hear, WB2CUK. He lives in Farmingdale. A MetLife blimp was dwelling over his house for significant periods of time during the golf tournament that's going on. And he asked us to make a guess as to what frequency was being used to send the data from the MetLife blimp back to NBC headquarters, I guess, in New York City. Got a guess on that one, Eric? Go ahead.
Yeah, the blimp is actually 2 point, it's actually a couple bands. They used it, I mean, they have three systems. There's the BAS band, which is the Broadcast Auxiliary Service band, which actually has been shrunk, thank you, from the Nextel. But they're running around 2.7 gigs, 2.6 gigs. I can give you the exact channel if you want to know. Then there's another band of frequencies between 6 and 7 gigs, and then there's another band of frequencies at 12. So, but what they're doing is they're going from the blimp to a ground truck, a ground-based receiver. They were also using the receiver, actually, on my tower, which is also sent back to New York. But they don't go directly back to NBC. What happens is there's a whole group of production trucks there. When the signal finally leaves, it goes to a satellite truck, and it goes straight from the satellite and gets distributed.
Okay, so I think you're saying there's a real headquarters-like thing. What am I looking at? A broadcast center, a local broadcast center in the vicinity of Best Page at the golf course that decides, okay, we're going to listen to camera number 41 now, and Tiger is on T of 17, and we're going to flip over to camera number 37 next. I think those decisions, there's a mini studio of some kind in the Best Page area. Is that true, Eric? Go ahead.
Yeah, I think. Imagine a 40-foot trailer with expanding sides, okay? You know the control room that's in my studio, and all of the electronics. And just envision all of that in a, you know, long 40-foot trailer, and then multiply that by a couple of them, because they also have the graphics truck out there with a flame and a few other things that do all those nice, nifty effects. And they've got probably two or three audio trucks to handle all the microphones all over the place. They probably have two or three satellite uplink trucks, because you always want redundancy. You don't want to be caught with your pants down to not having any failures. And then there's the utility or the whip guy's trucks, which, you know, has all the crane mounts and the mounts for the cameras, you know, and then there's, they use fiber optic these days, actually, for the HD stuff. We don't run copper anymore. So they can run 5,000 feet between the truck or 8,000 feet between the truck without a little repeater. And they literally cover before the event and bury all the cables and put them just where they need them. And, yeah, there's a whole production center there right behind the clubhouse.
Wow. And that is extremely valuable real estate at this time. You got a zillion people who want to park their car. You got a zillion people who want to pay their $100 or $150 for the ticket and be in the stand and watch Tiger do his thing.
They can't. They have to park at Jones Beach.
Wow. So in other words, all those people were shipped in by bus because the real estate is so valuable. And all those zillions of remote cameras on all of those individual holes of the black course, are you saying they're all interconnected by fiber, not by RF? Is that what I think you're saying, Eric? Go ahead.
Yeah, the broadcast industry has grown up over the years. Yeah, we use fiber for the connection between the cameras and the truck. And if there's long runs for audio these days, we use fiber with the devices that break out into bits of audio on both ends. And it's a heck of a lot easier than doing it in the old electronic way.
On the 18th hole, Tiger made a very good putt. Just barely made it. And very exciting, and everybody cheered, hollered, and whatever. And then they played it back to you four different ways from different cameras and different angles and whatever. Was that recorded and played back? Do you believe that was locally, or do you think that was done in New York City? Over to you, Eric.
As I said it before, that New York City has nothing to do with anything. It's all done in the production trucks. It's a company called NEP that actually provides the facilities. And the complete thing is completely done on the premises. Nothing else is done outside. The only thing that's done outside is they roll commercials. So and that's what the video production business is all about. So the kinds of things we do, like my friends at All Mobile, they have a whole bunch of trucks. They'll go and do, you know, the Tony Awards, to this, to that, the other thing. or even the baseball game. Well, the baseball game's actually getting a little different now, because Major League Baseball, a bunch of my friends work there, they just built this huge media center. They actually have, I think, 4 or 6 cameras from each stadium throughout the entire system. So every baseball game that's being played winds up in Secaucus, New Jersey, for distribution on the internet and other types of things. And generally, the stadiums will hire a production company to permanently leave the vehicle for the duration of the season, or however long a contract they sign. K2RW, K2JF.
You're amazingly strong on the input. Am I correct in guessing that you're working very late? You're in Syosset?
Oh, me?
Yeah. Boy, you are a dedicated individual. Thank you, Eric.
Yeah, no, I'm not at home. It just happened to be... Actually, right now, you're getting right-hand circular polarization from me.
You're getting the 60 over 9. How many watts are you radiating? And you're at the home QTH.
You know, it's my satellite tracking beam. I can switch it from left-hand circularly polarized to right-hand circularly polarized. I'm only running about 10 watts, Dick.
Wow. Fantastic. Okay. Who have I been holding off? I know I got to go to Paul, and Paul's got to get up early in the morning. He may have gone to bed already, and I would understand. Paul, are you still there for the US2M, KQRAW? It doesn't surprise me that we lost Paul. Is there anyone else who had a question or a comment? If so, give me your call letters right now, KQRAW.
WS2N is still here. Dick.
Okay. You probably got a few comments on all you've heard. Also, you heard me say before that PBS, the McNair, the Dallaire report on Wednesday had a section on NASA about the Orion controversy, the fact that there was a hearing held before Congress, the fact that a number of the engineers at NASA are anonymously working simultaneously for this other organization that is doing some of the redesign of Orion, but NASA is not responding. They're going to just follow through with the prototypes they're making. And so this thing that was on the Lair report, I went to the website to try to see the playback, and it's not there. No matter how I probe various words of NASA, Orion, or whatever, they just don't recognize that they ever transmitted that. So the fact that it got removed is, to me, overly interesting. WS2N for any comments on all the above, K2RIW.
I haven't heard that particular report. There's been some conflicting reports saying that some people want to, you know, scrap the program or just redo it, sending people in cargo all in one. Right now it's separate. You know, you have an individual cargo system. The whole system is called the Constellation system. Constellation system includes the cargo heavy lift vehicle, essentially an external tank that they use for the shuttle, with two solid boosters, one to the left, one to the right. On top of that, you're going to have another rocket engine, very similar to what they use on the shuttle itself, to put the heavy lift cargo into orbit. Heavy lift cargo might be something going up to the International Space Station, maybe another module, maybe even down the road a piece. You're going to have the next lunar craft that will land on the moon attached to that. Good system. That no people are on board. To launch 6 astronauts in space, you'll have the separate craft to put astronauts aboard. 16 foot diameter, similar looking shape of Apollo, where you had 3, you'll be able to put 6 on board. If you're going to go to the moon, you'll launch 4 astronauts. They would dock with the
the Luna craft, which was put up by the previous mentioned cargo craft, and then he's able to separate from that. Go to lunar injections to send people to the moon. Basically, that's the whole system. Coming back, you don't have another system where you don't have anybody on board on going around the moon, where you had three astronauts going to the...
Repeater, timeout.
There are some people that want to change that system to all-in-one. I'm not in favor of that, but that I've heard. So if that's part of the discussion, that's what's going on, I'm not sure. I know President Obama, last I heard, he still has appointed an administrator. Michael Griffin he's going to be gone, and you basically have nobody right now. They did plan on putting another guy in office, an astronaut that is very active in promoting the space agency. I forgot what his name is, but I don't know, it was a month or two ago. I haven't heard anything about him lately. That's what I know about it, Isaac. Of course, you've got the lunar orbiter that was launched recently. That was part of the problem with Endeavour. Endeavour was supposed to go up and put the final piece of Kaibo up. Kaibo is the International Space Station component from Japan. All the countries have different components. European Space Agency has the Columbia module. We have the Destiny module. The Russians have the Zarya and Zedza modules and things of that nature. The Japanese component, which is Kaibo, which is three pieces, two have been already put up to the space station. The third, an outdoor platform that's scheduled to go up with Endeavour, was canceled, delayed due to a hydrogen leak, 4 or 5 days, and then they tried again, the same problem existed, and they didn't have time to rework the problem because they had the lunar orbiter to get off the ground. So I think that's going to be delayed probably for quite a while into July before Endeavour goes up. Endeavour, you might remember, was the emergency vehicle that was on standby for Atlantis. Atlantis had gone up to the space station, up to the Hubble Space Telescope.
Repeater, time out.
You got to be a little bit careful on timing out there. Paul, go ahead.
I thought I was on the... Okay. I don't have my earphones on. I should have put them on. There's also a rumor that they plan on possibly extending the shuttle flights for at least another year. I don't know if that's going to come about, though. There's a lot of people that want to see that go at least to 2011. The present plan is 2010 to shut it down. I hope you don't lose too much. Back to you, WSUN.
Yeah, I'm in favor of extending the shuttle because the Orion / Constellation is not going to be there in time. That's going to be a long period of time, of multiple years, in which we're going to be dependent on the Soviet launch vehicles. What is the current schedule for Constellation or Orion being ready to roll and take things up to the International Space Station? Over to you, Paul.
I think you're looking at minimum 4 years before they even have a first test launch. Bringing material to the space station at least 5 years down the road there. So, plan, and you know, the ultimate plan to put people back on the moon, you're looking at, it looks like 2020, 2019, the earliest, 10 years down the road from today.
So, 2014, in your mind, about the earliest that we can have a shuttle substitute, and if they cut off shuttle in 2010, That's 4 years of having no launch of our own, and I can't believe we're happy with that. The shuttle is not perfect, and it's had some failures, but and it's amazing to me that they can't stop the foam from coming off the external tank. If there was no foam coming off the external tank, there wouldn't be a problem. And as I see it, the foam coming off the external tank is most likely to recur when you launch on the second day as opposed to the first day. If you get scrubbed the first day and you get the cryogenic fluids fitting in those tanks and you get the cryopumping taking place, in other words, water out the atmosphere is continuously condensing onto that foam and eventually making a chunk of ice. And it's the chunk of ice that falls off with the foam that does the damage. I would much rather see them continue using the shuttle, but set a brand new set of rules where you always launch on the first day. They've never had a failure when you launch on the first day. It's only when you launch on the second day and you've got the ice buildup. Has anyone ever said those words to your knowledge, Paul, from the US2N, K2RIW?
Besides me and you, I really haven't. I can't say that I've heard anybody say that. But I've got a 20-year-old car, you know, and the thing, I know I could have made it another 10, 20 years with the car if I had garaged it. I didn't. They're heating and cooling and heating and cooling over and over again. And basically, you that's what you're doing to these crafts. You know, we put them on a launch pad, and then now you've got to shut it down for 2 days and drain all the fluids and then bring it back up again. It's not good. Even Challenger, you know, they talked about the O-rings. All right, they were in an imperfect design. They changed everything. They made it like a J-type of hook where, and, you know, afterwards, to try to prevent that problem. But, you know, that thing was delayed, five times before that went up. Just heating and cooling. I think, you know, I mean, nothing's perfect for an improper design. I mean, they didn't come up with a better design afterwards, but even that, you know, you say to yourself, you know, did that, you know, weaken the O-rings to some extent, you know, made it easier for a gas bypass for what happened, what occurred on that flight? It can't be good. Contraction or expansion. Goes back to, you know, the old days. Let me drop it. When they used to weld ships together, you know, I mean, they still do, but when you weld the ship together, they say if you decided to only weld one side of the ship, the port side, the starboard side, and just left it alone, the difference would be 6 inches. I mean, there's tremendous contraction in, you know, the metal gaskets. It just can't be good, Dick. I agree 100%. Yes, you're right on with that. If you could fuel these things, launch them, day one, you're good to go. That's one of the good reasons I like the new design for the launch of people, you know, on board the Orion is you're sitting on top. Again, similar to an Apollo mission. If you look at the old Apollo flights, the ice stuff that's coming off of those tanks, you can see it always in slow motion. They always show slow motion launches. Well, that wasn't coming back and hitting the craft. You know, I mean, if you were to launch a shuttle like that, you're going to have tons of ice coming back and foam and God knows what coming down and hitting the craft. That's really what's been going on, and you're trying to stop that. You know, how do you stop something that's cryogenically cooled and heated and cooled and porous to some degree? Expanding and contracting. Look at concrete. Look what happens to that. You know, expand you put concrete outside, it's going to crack over time. And to some extent, that's what goes on with all the foam. You're going to break loose. You're not going to stop it from coming loose. But you can't launch a thermos bottle with no protection around it and think that the foam is going to stay on. It's not going to happen. Back to you, Dick.
I hear you. And I hope they hear us. I'm convinced that the problem of the breakup of foam and ice off of that external tank is two or three times greater in probability when you get scrubbed on the first day but leave the cryogenics on board and you launch on the second day. And I could make a case that the Challenger was lost because of the jammed bolt on the door. The handle of the door, they couldn't remove it. That's the reason why they scrubbed on the first day. And then that night they had real freezing weather, and then things went downhill after that. So had they launched on the first day, if there wasn't a cross-threaded hexagonal bolt that holds the handle onto the door. And they also brought up a drill motor to try to drill out that bolt. But the drill motor arrived with a dead NICAD battery.
Huh.
Terrible. Alrighty. Hey, we've only got a couple of minutes left. We never did get to the mailbag tonight, Mel. But still, you had a lot of good words. I hope the people that you're helping to align digital television and get them running are not still accusing you of causing the problem. You're trying to help them. K2KEY, K2RIW.
This is K2KEY. Yeah, I had a couple of ventures, but I don't want to get into it that late, but it was a favor, and I'm sorry in one way that I even said anything, because I'll tell you, at the end, I got blamed for the whole thing. I was getting blamed. The geriatric people are not really understanding. That's the bottom line. In fact, we know a young lady that works over at Senator Simbowitz's office here in the local Senate, the Assembly, the New York City Assembly, that has the local office here. And she says those, actually, she says that we had to really lock the door. The people were just crazed, she says, what happened. And it seems that this, you know, converter boxes and all did not reach as many people as we thought it did. A lot of them, either for some reason, just ignored it right up to the end. Over.
Normal procrastination. That's predictable. But a certain percentage of the population would do that. Every single channel, every couple of hours, for weeks ahead of time, we're telling you, this is coming. Get ready for it. You got to do this, this, and this, or else. Lots and lots of warning. I guess everyone said, well, it ain't going to happen to me. I guess we should be thankful that a high percentage of the people are on some form of television service.
Hey, you know, they delayed the whole thing.
Yep. And from the February 17th date to the June 12th date, they delayed it and gave them every possible chance. Okay, we got 45 seconds left, Mel. This was TechNet number 1,250. Assuming that Mel and I stay healthy, we'll be back next week and try to solve a few more of these problems. 73, you all, be kind to each other. You got it, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW. Hang in there, Mel. It's going to get a little worse where it gets better.
Just say the final words, everybody. Have a nice field day, and you know where I am. If anyone wants to come down to Floyd Bennett, except we're at Building 272, not the Ryan Visitor Center. It is closed for overhauling. So we're at just come in the field as you usually do if you've come there before, and just go straight up. Don't make any
12 a.m.
This is for the Marine Parkway Bridge.
73 golf from
Steve. Many of you down there at field day.
And
we'll
next tonight
at
8:30. Next tonight at 8:30.
Hey, Dick.
I'm
sure you know your space shuttle flight.
Although I'm not coming through. Oh, you know I am. Quick question for you, Mel, and then I'll go over to Eric. Mel, the when I go to the ARRL website where it shows you all the locations of all of the field day sites, I did not see Kings County Radio Club. I saw the other Kings County Club, but not Kings County Radio Club listed. So maybe that's been corrected. I'll hear you on the other channel, Mel, even though you're not coming through the machine. Don't worry. K2... K2KEY, K2LIW. Okay, so it didn't get listed, but we now know to look for you at Building 272, not the Orion Building. and roughly how many feet away in what direction, north, south, east, and west, is building 272, Mel? K2KEY, K2LIW? Okay, there's two different ways of listening to all the way a quarter of a mile. When I enter, if I kept going straight,